This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
In 1938, 39, 40, 41, there was a whole group of women, mostly played by Betty Davis and Katharine Hepburn, and of course Vivian Leigh here, that were headstrong and willful and spoiled and had to be humiliated. But Scarlett never does that. She never has to stand there and say, I'm ashamed of what I've been. I will be other.
That's film critic Molly Haskell. We talk with her about her new book, Frankly, My Dear, Gone with the Wind Revisited. Later, we talk with the playwrights of the Enchanted Circle Theater. Their annual production of the Skinner Servants Tour is playing this week through March 15th.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Margaret Mitchell's 1937 novel Gone with the Wind is one of the best-selling books of all time, some 30 million copies. And the movie version, produced by David Selznick and released 2 years later, has sold more tickets than any other film in U.S. history. Why is this epic of a war that tore our country apart, featuring a woman, Scarlett O'Hara as the hero, held such sway over the American imagination? Gone with the Wind's story of triumph over adversity resonated powerfully with an American public struggling for survival during the Great Depression. And later, each generation has found its own reasons to admire the story. But the book and movie have also been roundly condemned for racism, idealizing slavery and the racial relations of the antebellum South, and feminists have cringed at the romanticization of Scarlett's rape by Rhett Butler. Yet, says my guest Molly Haskell, in Scarlett O'Hara, Gone with the Wind is anchored in a strong, capable female character who prospers through her own ingenuity. Molly Haskell has written extensively on women in film, including her 1973 classic, From Reverence to Rape, The Treatment of Women in the Movies. Now she's turned her attention to Gone with the Wind, with Frankly, My Dear, Gone with the Wind Revisited. It's a marvelous dissection of the personalities around the book and the movie, and the place of this iconic story in American life. Molly Haskell, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. There. Both here and there.
Your book, Frankly, My Dear, Gone with the Wind Revisited, is a really marvelous analysis, kind of a cultural history, a kind of personal history. What moved you to write about this film?
Well, actually, I don't think I ever would have done it. The idea wouldn't have occurred to me. For so many reasons. One, I think it had been sort of a politically vexed film, especially in earlier decades, and it was one. I never was a fanatic for Gone with the Wind. It had made a huge impression on me when I was young, but I didn't take it that seriously, just like most thinking people. But Yale University Press is doing the series American Icons, and they came to me with the idea, and the more I got into it, the more excited I was by it, just because I think it is one of those sort of monuments that's in the elephant in plain sight that we've taken for granted and haven't analyzed, and it changes, like all movies, it sort of changes what seemed interesting at one time, sort of fades, and something else comes to the surface. So it mutates over time, and that's interesting, and there's so many issues in it. There's the South and the Reconstruction, feminism. Scarlett's really a kind of feminist avant la lettre. I mean, she's a terrible, infuriating heroine and anti-heroine, and yet there's something courageous and brave, and she's fiercely independent. All of these things made her always very interesting to me. And just sort of thinking about it in an atmosphere that I think has changed since in the 70s, we found the portrait of blacks in Reconstruction just cringe-inducing. That was we almost couldn't see it any other way. And then since then, I think enough progress has been made that the tension has lessened a bit, and black scholars and others have talked about how extraordinary these black actors were, particularly, of course, Hattie McDaniel and Butterfly McQueen, and how they turned these stereotypes into something much grander and more interesting, and that there were better parts than most blacks were getting at the time. So I think this makes it much more interesting to talk about now that we can somehow talk more freely about it.
Yeah, and as you say, I mean, here you are writing about an American icon. Gone with the Wind came out in 1936, the book, a bestseller. The movie came out in 1939. You start out with the reception of the movie as, you know, its birth as an icon, basically.
Mm-hmm.
What has the movie meant for its audiences through time? What are some of the common, certainly it's been seen in different ways at different periods.
That's right. I think this is what makes it so powerful, because there's so many themes in it that have been, I mean, somebody was comparing it to Godfather, and Godfather's a great film, but it's not epic in the same way that Gone with the Wind is. I mean, this is about the war between the North and the South, and there have been really no movies. The Birth of a Nation came earlier, and since then, I mean, there's been very little. Coal Mountain and a few others that are sort of not very prominent. And so this is our war, the major war that was ever fought on American soil. But for other countries and other tribes, it's been just as, if not more, meaningful. It was banned, both the book and the movie, by Goebbels during the war because he considered it insurrectionary.
Joseph Goebbels, from the Nazi head of broadcasting and public information.
Yeah.
That's right.
He considered it too seditious, and so it was released after the war. And Olivia de Havilland and other people also have talked about how the French just greeted it rapturously because it was a story of a triumph over oppressors. So any country that's gone through this kind of oppression or victimization in any way and has survived, it's about surviving. And when it came out in 1939 here, everyone saw it as a Depression fable, because it was sort of the tail end of the Depression, but people weren't out of it yet. And although the book, of course, came out right in 36, in the middle of the Depression, but Margaret Mitchell had been writing it in the 20s. She actually, in the 30s, was mostly just tinkering with the manuscript and sort of hanging on to it, ambivalent about whether to let it go or not. But she wrote it out of her jazz age rebellion against her mother, who was this very sort of straight-laced suffragette activist, and Margaret Mitchell was a scapegrace. She read porn and did all sorts of wild things, and so Scarlet, she was a bit of a Scarlet then, and it was also this period of sort of excess and indulgence followed by the shockwaves of the Depression, and the Civil War was the same thing, and the antebellum time was a period of luxury and indulgence, and then suddenly the war, and the South was completely devastated. They didn't call it depression, but it certainly was one. And now it'll be interesting to see if people react in the same way again, because in a sense, Scarlett was in some ways a forerunner of some of the sort of female images and icons of more recent years, like Madonna, the sort of survive at any cost aspect of Madonna, or the shopaholic of Sex in the City and Confessions of a Shopaholic, all these mad, narcissistic shoppers. Only the difference is that Scarlett was really doing, and so many of the horrible things she did, even stealing her sister's fiancé to marry him, were not just for herself and not for love. She was hardly a romantic. Well, she was in the sense that she had this unrequited love for Ashley that went on and on and on. But in most other ways, she was pretty much a skeptic and a realist. But she married Frank Kennedy in order to save Tara. That was her great goal, was to get enough money to pay the taxes on Tara so she could sustain not only the farm but the people that lived on it. So there was a nobler goal in her greed and her ruthlessness.
And Tara was her ancestral,
ancestral
plantation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which was in the book, of course, just a fairly modest farm, but of course became something much grander in David Selznick's interpretation of it in the movie.
One thing I was surprised at is you say that in the 60s and 70s or even later that African-American women also had a positive identification with Scarlett O'Hara.
They did. And, you know, I was on a radio show just the other day and talking to an NPR station in Texas, a call-in station, and this woman called in and started describing how she, when she was a teenager, and it's just, this is almost universal, she was reading it under the covers with a flashlight, which we all did, because there was something racy and not quite, I mean, this was a book that we discovered on our own. It wasn't on any reading list. But that's the way she read it, in hiding, and identified with Scarlett, and it turned out she was a black woman. And she'd grown up on an army post, and she did not see it as a, I mean, she had completely identified with Scarlett, with her as a teenager. Every teenager, black or white, did. And I think what this makes us realize that that it's like gender. When you're young, when you're a teenage girl, you very often identify with the cowboy hero and not the girlfriend. It's the protagonist is who we identify with. So I think it's sort of patronizing to expect that blacks will be rigidly identifying only with blacks on the screen, or that females will only identify with females. So I thought that was very interesting. And I think, again, I think there's enough distance now from it that we can see it a little more objectively and less with less intense kind of political agenda, I think.
One of the things that's so interesting about your treatment of Gone with the Wind, and I'm speaking with Molly Haskell, her book is Frankly, My Dear, Gone with the Wind Revisited. One of the things that's so interesting is how, in a way, this movie is poised on the cusp of changes toward the future, as you point out, a kind of a new kind of heroine, almost a feminist heroine, yet celebrating the most backward, retrograde features of the old society.
Absolutely.
The old South.
It is, and I think this is partly the divided nature of Margaret Mitchell herself, because she was a child of the South. She was devoted to the South. She lived in Atlanta all of her life, and by the time she finished the book, all she wanted to do was to stay within the good graces of all the people of Atlanta. But she had been a rebel. She'd been a real rebel. She'd caused a big scandal at a dance that the Junior League wouldn't have her because she'd behaved so disgracefully, and she loved reading porn, all this stuff. So there was this rebel in her, and then she became, she sort of went from Scarlett to Melanie. Also, she'd had a series of accident. She'd had a bad ankle from an early riding injury, and it just kept being re-wounded, and she had illnesses, and so she had to turn in her dancing shoes for orthopedic shoes, so she became very matronly and kind of withdrawn. But Melanie, and she says she started out to make Melanie, who, of course, is the ultimate quintessential Southern lady, the heroine, and I don't know whether we can completely believe her on that, but I do think to some extent Scarlett just took over. There was something wild and almost animal-like in Scarlett and the life force she represented. So Margaret Mitchell was completely torn between these two. And Melanie, and when we came along in the 50s as teenagers, we just thought Melanie was a goody two-shoes because we were beginning to rebel. And it would be the 60s and 70s before the women's movement actually came to express these feelings. But the word lady was something that we were impatient with. It was sort of in disrepute, and Melanie was the ultimate lady. She was strong, fiercely strong, but she hid it, and she masked it with a deference to men and to the patriarchy and to all of that, which Scarlett didn't at all. She challenged it completely. So you have these two different versions of femaleness, of femininity, that are being questioned, which is something very modern, and it hadn't been completely resolved yet.
You're pointing to some of the contradictions in the book and the contradictions in society that the book also points to. It also didn't find a very comfortable place, as you say, resting place in the rambling house of literature, possibly because of some of these contradictions. You have a wonderful paragraph, which I'll read here. You say, it didn't find a comfortable resting place in the rambling house of literature, being not so much above criticism as beyond classification, an unholy concatenation of high romance and deftly delivered history, veering in tone and level of accomplishment from the ridiculous to the almost sublime, from reflexive racism to a feelingly accurate attention to the speech and behavior of Negroes, from the pulpier reaches of women's prose to complex historical storytelling that moves at a breakneck speed, except when it doesn't.
Yeah, that sort of sums it up and doesn't resolve anything, right? Like the war between the North and the South. Yeah, it is. I think this is why people have just left it alone, in a way, why they haven't come back and revisited it, because it's just, when it came out, they could dismiss it as woman's fiction. You know, there was this whole, it was a real, you know, men's club of fiction writing and arbitrary. I mean, there was a lot of women's prose, but it was always derided as women's prose. So this could be sort of conveniently ghettoized as that, and yet it was something more than that. It wasn't just this historical romance, because it did have a broader, certainly you know, epic sense of history and a tremendous attention to detail. And it's not just a woman's film, which is what most people would like to dismiss it as. A lot of men have loved it, not just as boys who were smitten with Vivian Leigh, but because even though there are no actual battle scenes, you get as much of a sense of the devastation of war and of war, or the feeling of war, as you get in any war film. I mean, it's not just the home front story. It's much more than that. So it does reach out in all these different directions. And she's so full of contradictions. I think it's what's kept people from talking about it, but it's what's kept it alive, because it's not just woman's romance. I mean, woman's romance, the woman gets the man, he and she both are sort of mutually transformed by love. Well, there's no transformation here. There's none of that sanctimony that you usually get whereby, I mean, it just occurred to me, I was looking at Dark Victory the other night, in 1938, 39, 40, 41, there was a whole group of women, mostly played by Bette Davis and Katharine Hepburn and, of course, Vivian Leigh here, that were headstrong and willful and spoiled and had to be humiliated. Katharine Hepburn in Philadelphia Story, Bette Davis in Dark Victory and Jezebel. I mean, they all had to be, I think women sort of were excited by these headstrong, willful women, but at the same time, they just didn't approve of them. But Scarlett never does that. She never has to stand there and say, I'm ashamed of what I've been. I will be other. She never does that, and that's very unusual. But I think it's also what's given her an edge and a sort of enduring power that maybe some of the other roles don't have. Well, I shouldn't say that, because they're terrific films, too, but I think there's something very modern and autonomous. I mean, she's not sort of brought to heel the way so many heroines are.
Hmm. We're talking with film critic Molly Haskell about Gone with the Wind, the book and the movie, and the role it's played in the American mind as an icon.
Yeah, you know, I found it interesting, too, as you're talking, you're doing what I do as well with this, as I conflate the movie and the book. I mean, I kind of move back and forth between the two genres in talking about the same film. Could you talk a little bit about the connection between the movie and the book? In the sense, I mean, it was not an easy movie to make. There was a lot of back and forthing between the author and the producers.
Yeah.
And yet there is a single identity that emerges.
Very much so. Well, it was a 1,000-page book, and everybody thought it couldn't be made into a movie. But Selznick was one of these people who, he was sort of unusual at that time. He was very interested in doing books. He'd done Dickens and all sorts of English classics, and he was very, and I think it's one reason Margaret Mitchell trusted him and wanted him to do it. He was very faithful to it, and with this, he treated it like Holy Scripture. He didn't want a word of dialogue changed. Sidney Howard is the official screenwriter, and I think he did most of it, but there were a lot of other screenwriters that worked on it. And there's some things I think the book has that are missing in the movie, some characters, particularly some interesting women and black characters. But basically, I think the movie really streamlines the book, and I think the Red Butler character is more interesting in the movie. He's a bit of a know-it-all in the book, but Clark Gable gives him something very virile and strong and manly, which, I mean, I think that also keeps it from being, just strictly speaking, a woman's film. Because when you think about it, it really is her film. She's on screen almost all the time, and he's a fairly passive character. But because it's Clark Gable, you don't think of him as passive. So I think the casting is just brilliant. I mean, I think without that, it wouldn't have worked. And there were, I think Selznick did have and Menzies, William Cameron Menzies, the art director, certainly gives it a look that is a brilliant and unifying sort of this wild, lurid technicolor that's consistent throughout and intense, and, of course, the Max Steiner score. So you have all the sort of the best craftsmen that money could buy trying to create this single thing, and miraculous they did. I mean, usually when you have that many kind of artists and craftsmen and not a single great director, because he changed directors. First started with George Cukor, and then he fired Cukor mostly because he was just too slow and meticulous. He really was a woman's director and not an epic director. Brought in Victor Fleming, but then this, Gable never liked Cukor that much because he was a woman's director and felt that he, Gable, was being slighted. So then he got Victor Fleming, who was his guy on the set. But meanwhile, the two women were going to Cukor on the side, so getting coaching. So this was a kind of male-female yin and yang that also, I think, is what gives the movie its it's strong sexual dynamics, an male-female equilibrium.
And Vivian Leigh was, of course, so much of a part of that, and yet she was not the first actress considered for the role of Scarlett.
By no means. In fact, they'd already started shooting in December of 1938. They were shooting The Burning of Atlanta, and they had gone through every actress in Hollywood and then some. Everyone wanted the part. Every single actress thought she was Scarlett. That's how, I mean, it's part of what we were saying about the contradictions in it. You can just pick your characteristic. She's, because there's such a spectrum in Scarlett. I mean, the only one who just wasn't right for it was Norma Shearer, and her fan club let her know it, that they didn't want her to play Scarlett because she was too nice to play such a hoyden. But everybody else wanted the part, and Selznick wisely wanted an unknown because he didn't want one of the big stars like Davis or Hepburn, because then it would be a Betty Davis picture. He wanted it to be a David Selznick picture, but I think he knew they would bring baggage and associations. And then here they were shooting The Burning of Atlanta, this spectacular scene. They had all these fire trucks and policemen in case things got out of hand. And his brother Myron, the agent, had been having dinner with Laurence Olivier and Vivian Leigh, who, of course, were in love with each other and having an affair. And Vivian Leigh had paid her way to America. She wanted this part so much. And so Myron brought them to the set and introduced her to David Selznick and said, "Here's your Scarlett." And, of course, it probably took a few days longer, but, you know, the legend is that he was immediately realized that she was the one. He saw her green eyes dancing in the fire, reflecting the fire. And it's a kind of wonderful image, though, of the fire and desperation, because I think in Mitchell, Selznick, and Leigh, there was a strange sort of complementarity of neurosis, of intensity, of manic depression. I mean, they all were basically manic depressives without getting too clinical. And Vivian Leigh would later be diagnosed with not only manic depression, but tuberculosis and even schizophrenia. I mean, she was really about to become very sick, and I think some of her feverishness and her greatness in the part is because of that.
A kind of driven...
Driven, exactly. Yeah.
Quality. Mm. Just as an aside, my grandmother was a friend of Vivian Leigh's.
Oh, really?
She was the mistress of the casting director of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer.
Oh, my God.
And I've got photographs of them at dances together, you know.
Oh, God, I'd love to see those. That's fantastic.
She played a bit part in Pride and Prejudice, but her boyfriend just never let her get a good part because he didn't want to share her with anybody else.
That's so interesting. Well, I think Laurence Olivier was by no means a big supporter of Vivian Leigh either. Mm. I mean, I think she basically gave up her career for him, and certainly her movie career. She wanted to be on the stage to get his respect and the respect of his peers.
Wow.
But that's interesting. So that was in Hollywood?
Yeah.
She grew up there.
Well, she didn't grow up there. She won a beauty contest in Florida, and the prize was to go to Hollywood.
Oh, my God.
And get a screen test.
Oh, that's a classic story. was she beautiful?
She was absolutely drop-dead gorgeous. She was a model.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Now to the third member of this triumvirate, Vivian Leigh and Margaret Mitchell, David Selznick. Tell us about him.
Well, he was a wunderkind. He was the second generation of these Jewish moguls that had come to Hollywood from other businesses. And his father was a kind of profligate who really had a studio but just managed it very badly. And David and his brother Myron were convinced that it was the big studios that had done him in. So they were determined to get revenge, which was one of the forces driving both of them. And David just started producing very early and very successfully. He worked with Cukor on A Bill of Divorcement and Little Women, and he'd had all these classic successes. And with Gone with the Wind, he was just determined. And he was risking, everybody was taking a big risk, but he was taking the biggest of all, not only with his money, and he had to sell half of it to MGM to get it made and bargain with everybody for this and that, or just to get the word damn into it, that kind of thing. But he was so obsessional that he did no detail was too small for him, including the women's dresses. And he loved women, which is something you just don't see in Hollywood anymore. A producer who not only loves women as love objects, but identifies with them and appreciates them. And they all would tell stories about, Olivia de Havilland tells about trying on this dress and going in to see him, and It was her one pretty dress. She had to dress plain for most of the movie, and she loved this dress. And she was leaving the room, and he looks and said, no, not four ruffles, three. So I made her take off one ruffle. So he was just that detail-oriented about it. And he was up all night. Nobody could keep up with him. He was on speed or Benzedrine or whatever would keep him up. And he was an impediment, too, because he wanted to be a writer, and some part of him wanted to be a writer, as reflected in the wonderful memos that he left behind. But he was trying to do work on the screenplay, and by all accounts, everything he did was awful and was just slowing things up. But he did pick well. I mean, not only the casting, but the art direction, and the directing somehow worked out. So I mean, he did have a genius, and I think it really is at its height here. He went on to do good movies, but I think because this was so successful, and also the other thing was that people were just sick of it because he conducted the search for Scarlett in public. He loved him, and he was sending out press releases, and he felt that he had this sort of direct line to the public, and there was this courtship, and he was courting them, and everybody, the press was sick of this movie. By the time it got there, the people in it were sick of it. Everybody was sick of it, but it was because he was just so relentless. And when it succeeded, he thought he could do no wrong. So I think after that, he was just a complete megalomaniac, and he had to have his name on everything as writer, and just I think he felt he could do no wrong, and that was bad. And you know, all three of these people, I think, were in some way consumed. Used up early by the movie, and all of them died young. Really, he sounds like the oldest at 63, but Margaret Mitchell was 49, and Vivian Leigh was, I think, 53.
Wow. Yeah, you know, there's a kind of irony, too, of Selznick here, part of a Hollywood dominated by Jewish immigrants. He was the son of a Jewish immigrant.
Mm-hmm.
They always saw America as a promised land, and
yeah.
Here he's producing a movie that really elides over the perniciousness and brutality of America's greatest shame, slavery.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there was a whole fondness for that. There was another risk he was taking because Civil War movies were suddenly off the agenda because there'd been a couple of failures. But before that, there were a great many, and not just Birth of a Nation, but just a huge number, because these immigrants, they were creating their image of America, and they loved the South sort of was wonderful family unity and sort of holding out against the oppressor, so they could sort of transform or transfuse all of their experiences as a victimized and minority into the South, into an idealized version of the South. And I think Selznick, he began to realize, though, while he was making this, there could be trouble from blacks and the NAACP and all that. So he became quite sensitive to it. I mean, for his time, he really was. He didn't want to go down like D.W. Griffith and have a movie that was completely dismissed because of how racist it was. So he tried to be careful. On the other hand, he didn't want to just eviscerate the movie. He didn't want to have a black spokesperson on the set censoring what he was doing. So I think if he had, he probably wouldn't have been able to get away with the character Prissy. But after that, for one thing, the blacks were treated much better, even though when it came to the premiere in Atlanta, Hattie McDaniel, who was the Academy Award winner, couldn't even go because of segregation. But in Hollywood and on the set, they were treated much better than, say, they had been on earlier films. And Gable was a big friend of Hattie McDaniel's, and he was one of the ones that made sure that they didn't feel excluded. However, when she won the award, she was in a kind of isolation. She was at the Roosevelt or wherever they gave him that year. She was sort of off by herself at a table, not with everybody else. So there was very serious segregation. But after this, Hollywood, I think largely because they saw what was happening in Germany and what could happen with the whole idea of a kind of ethnic cleansing and one race being segregated against and eliminated by another. So they passed laws that they would try to give better treatment to blacks in movies. So I think this was sort of the beginning of a greater awareness. It would take a while, but at least it was a beginning.
And Hattie McDaniel, as you point out, she played Mammy. She has a marvelous, you have a marvelous quote from her in the book that she says she got some criticism from other African-Americans, and she said, well, I'd rather be paid $700 a week playing a maid than earning $7 a week being one.
Exactly, and that's what she had been. And in fact, I think this is one of the arguments that I've made and others have against imposing a sort of ideological criteria on movie, is that Butterfly McQueen, I think, of course, she was more, I think, imprisoned in the role of Prissy, and her career was both blessed and blighted by that role. But in later years, she could have had a career. I mean, there were roles playing domestics, but the political agenda said we can't see blacks as domestics anymore, and so therefore they lost out on roles because that was what they had played. It was really basically what they could play. And if those roles were eliminated, if people were too sensitive to even show them, then it just meant they were out of work.
We're speaking with film critic Molly Haskell. She's written on the movies for The Village Voice, Vogue, and New York Magazine, among others. She grew up in the South, but has lived in the North for 40 years. We'll talk more about her book, Frankly, My Dear, after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. My guest, Molly Haskell, has been writing for a long time on how the movies see women. Gone with the Wind both observed social and Hollywood convention and broke with it. For one thing, when the film came out, Scarlett O'Hara's evident enjoyment of sex with Rhett Butler scandalized the self-appointed guardians of social morality. But later, feminists were disturbed that her enjoyment came on the heels of her rape by Rhett. I asked Molly Haskell about how the film treated sex. Now, you wrote one of the first feminist treatments of how women are portrayed in the movies. It's called From Reverence to Rape and came out in 1974. And in Frankly, My Dear, you turn your attention to how rape is treated in Gone with the Wind. And there are two different models of this, let's say. There's Rhett's rape of Scarlett first. Talk about your view of that in this film.
Well, this is another one of those issues that people were just adamant about in the 70s, marital rape, and they saw Rhett's ravishment of Scarlett when he's drunk and so angry and takes her up the step and stairs and they have sex. And I think, for one thing, you have to see this in the context of her reaction. And of course, she's aroused probably for the first time in her life, and you see it on her face in sort of bliss and like purring in the morning. So I make a distinction between fantasy, which is not that you want to be, you know, be attacked by an unknown assailant in a dark alley. A fantasy is you orchestrate, you give up responsibility, and it's say Clark Gable or Robert Redford won't take no for an answer. So it's a fantasy orchestrated by a woman for her own pleasure. And in fact, Margaret Mitchell had a horrible encounters with her first husband, who was a complete scoundrel and was violent and jealous of her and may have raped her or tried to rape her. But this is completely transformed in the book into something that these two incredibly stubborn characters have not been able to come together. And this is finally, Rhett is in a rage. He's jealous because she's given him reason to believe that she's still in love with Ashley, and yet she's his wife. And it's something that I think we've had a broader understanding of women's, the perversity of women's sexual fantasies, that all of these things are that you may, that the correct or high-minded thing is to be against any kind of force in any form. But I've known of women, and particularly Southern women, to whom this has happened, that they were very repressed. These are women who always want to be in control and very repressed, and suddenly the control is taken out of their hands, and it's a huge release. So that's, I think, what we're seeing there. That fantasy is what's being played out.
And the other fantasy, then, is the one that Scarlett gives some voice to, that dark fantasy of
freed blacks rampaging and raping white women.
Yeah, well, you don't really see that. When she's attacked, it is. I mean, this is the thing that Leslie Fiedler fastens on, and he even calls, I forget exactly what his term for Rhett is, but he's sort of a quasi-Negro hero, and speaks to this forbidden desire of white women for black men. So I think there is a touch of that. I think it's there. It's under the surface, or even maybe closer to the surface than that. I don't think you don't see the desire for it. It's just something that it's. I think most of that actually. I think that maybe I'm Southern and I'm repressing it myself, but it was a white male fear of the potency of the sexual black. You see this much more in something like Birth of a Nation, where the fear of intermarriage underlies this sense of rampaging blacks. I think much less so in Gone with the Wind, but then I think Margaret Mitchell is much more sexually repressed, and that's why in a way she turns against Clark Gable when she becomes more sort of conventional and tells Selznick that we in the South don't want to see Clark Gable play this role, where she's written a role that nobody could think of anybody but Clark Gable playing it. And suddenly she does an about-face, you know, because it's all how swarthy and this lurid descriptions of his rippling biceps and all that. And suddenly she says, no, we don't want him. We want Basil Rathbone. So
Basil Rathbone.
Yeah, that's who she was proposing. Or if not Basil Rathbone, Ronald Coleman or Frederick Marsh. I mean,
British gentility.
Yeah, more of these sort of drawing room, you know, British aesthetes. That's hardly what we think of as Rhett.
Yeah, well, I didn't mean to imply that Scarlett had that fantasy of black men, but more that the on the one hand there is this kind of more benign fantasy of rape, mm-hmm. when it comes between Rhett and Scarlett.
Yeah.
And on the other,
threat. It's more life-threatening. And she does have a lot of that in the book. And there's even a trial, because this is when, during Reconstruction, and there was this terror because suddenly blacks, you know, did outnumber whites in these states, and if they were going to get the vote and advance in state legislatures and that sort of thing, then there would be intermarriage. So I think this fear of intermarriage really is what underlies this, and of being somehow overrun by blacks. And there was, I think, a tremendous tension, and the thing about her picture of Reconstruction, although there were 20 years after the war when blacks did make progress and there was more education and more representation in state legislatures, then there was the reaction, and that whole period was sort of occluded from history, and people have blamed Margaret Mitchell, and it is a malign portrait of Reconstruction, but it was basically the prevailing one in the North and the South. I mean, the North is complicit in this view, too, until sort of recent years, the last 40 years, and historians like Eric Foner have brought out the very real progress that was made by blacks and progressives during that period right after the war.
You know, I started out this interview asking you about what Gone with the Wind had meant for its audiences and its readers through the decades. You were born and raised a Southerner. You have now lived in the North for 40 years. In writing this book, what has this meant for you in thinking about these issues, not just of, you know, Southern womanhood and gender, but also of race?
Well, it's been hugely liberating because I think I was tied in knots on the subject because I grew up in Richmond, and I love Richmond in so many ways, but it's deeply conservative. And, of course, it was Jim Crow segregation when I was growing up. And I think I fled to the North, not just for that reason, but that was part of it. I just needed a more liberal atmosphere. And yet, at the same time, I understood a lot about that. I thought, especially at that time, there was a lot of Northern bigotry towards the South. And the North felt very pure and high-minded compared to the South, and this used to rankle, too. So in some way, I think that's changed a lot, and that, too, has changed in recent years. And it's true that the South did hold the North and the country hostage. Southern conservatism was a very virulent force, has been for many, many years, and disturbingly powerful and reactionary. but some that has changed somewhat. And it enabled me, I think, when you write about something and find the tone with which to deal with it, it sort of brings some kind of resolution to you. And that, I think, the book has allowed me to do. And it's been wonderful from that far, because I think I wanted to give voice to both my northern and southern side, and I think I've been able to do that finally somehow.
Well, Molly Haskell, thanks so much for talking with us here. Your book, and it's a beautifully written book, too. Frankly, My Dear, Gone with the Wind Revisited.
Thank you, Francesca.
No, I don't think I will kiss you. Although you need kissing badly. That's what's wrong with you. You should be kissed and often, and by someone who knows how.
Next up, the Enchanted Circle Theater's Skinner Servants Tour. Stay tuned.
Guess you could say that me and young Mr. Skinner have had our share of problems. You know, I've even found stories about me in his journals.
Holyoke, Massachusetts was once home to some of the wealthiest families in America. During its heyday in the 19th and early 20th century, the mills of this typical New England factory town ran day and night, making the paper the city was famous for. But not just paper. One of the preeminent families of Holyoke was the Skinners, headed by the silk manufacturer William Skinner. His elegant mansion still dominates a hill overlooking the now mostly shuttered factories below. It's the Wisteria Hearst Museum now. Several years back, the Wisteria Hearst commissioned a local theater troupe, the Enchanted Circle Theater, to write a play about the history of the house and its family. Director Patricia Helwig teamed up with Rachel Kuhn Daviau to write the script. They decided to write it from the perspective of the Skinner family servants so that they could delve into some of the class realities that underlay the family's opulence. The year is 1927, and the servants are bringing a group of newspaper reporters, in reality the audience, on a tour of the house. In 2007, I talked with Helwig and Daviau in the music room of the mansion. It was built by William Skinner's sister, Belle, a woman of great spirit and intelligence. The room's wonderful acoustics make it a perfect place for concerts, for which it's still used today. I started out by asking the playwrights why they had chosen the year 1927 in which to set the play. Rachel Kuhn Daviau.
Part of it is based on the fact that there was this very short time period when this room existed, when Belle Skinner was still alive. And so there was this amazing confluence of us looking at timelines when all of the stories we liked the best and Belle Skinner and this space actually existed, and there's about a 6-month time period, so that nailed it for us in 1927.
Because Belle died shortly after this room was completed. And we knew we wanted to have Belle be in the story. And we sort of made a list of what were the most essential themes that we wanted to cover. We were interested in the disparity between the haves and the have-nots, and so focusing in on the servants and some family members told that story in a compelling way. We were also very interested in philanthropy, and so the family did a lot of philanthropy, as many wealthy people of the time did.
And that Catherine and Belle were such feminists and did so much for sort of women and children in Holyoke at the time, of course, got both of us pretty interested.
In terms of the container and how to sort of hook the audience in, the house became the next character. So we had a housekeeper and a chauffeur, and we had the family nurse, and we had the sister, but we have this gorgeous house to work with. And so we devised the concept, really, of monologues, so that you would meet each of the servants in a different room. So it would be a house tour, but it was also a sort of history lesson and a very personal connection with each of the servants in each of the rooms. So you meet the housekeeper who's talking about setting the table in the dining room and about how to sweep a floor properly and about how to run the household and all of the things that you're responsible for. You meet the family nurse on her break in the library as she's enjoying tea. You meet the personal assistant for Belle Skinner in Belle's bedroom, and she tells you about Belle's philanthropic endeavors. So the audience actually goes from room to room to room, where you're in each room for maybe 10 minutes. And so in terms of keeping an audience engaged and giving them sort of the whole scope of the home, you're doing that literally by moving the audience from room to room.
The other container for this play was to figure out why people would be coming to this house. And so, again, the audience is involved. When the audience walked in the door, they're greeted as members of the press, and they're here to interview Belle Skinner in advance of her meeting with the French ambassador. And so it's a press conference. And so members of the audience get press badges. And then as you're shown through the room while you're waiting for Belle to get ready, you, at the end of the show, wind up in this room for the press conference, and selected members of the audience have pre-printed questions to ask Belle Skinner in order that she answers. And so in that way, it keeps the audience involved. And, you know, you never know. We've had, you know, audience members just pop up with their very own question they thought up, you know, during their tour, unscripted. But it shows that people are engaged and that they're thinking. And what happens is, you know, people will sit in the dining room for 10 minutes while Hattie is talking, listening. But you also get a chance to sit in that room for 10 minutes and look around it in a way that you might never do on a tour, and to really imagine what it would be to sit at that table and be a dinner guest and experience that room. And in that way, the house comes alive as if you really are there, and it's 1927, and the actors are walking around in these gorgeous costume pieces. And so it's a real time out of time for people.
Priscilla Helweg and Rachel Kuhn-Davial. Now let's listen to actor James Emery playing the part of George Brakey, the Skinner family chauffeur. As the audience files in, he's washing windows in the breakfast nook. Brakey starts out talking to the audience, posing as reporters, genially enough. But after a few minutes, a darker tone creeps into his soliloquy.
One of these days, though, you mark my words, one of these windows in here, like that one, is going to break. And it's not going to be by George Brakey, because I ain't washing no more windows. I told Hattie, didn't you? Let me tell you a story about a horse. Well, this is back when we had horses, you know, before cars. Oh, he was a beaut, that Stanley. Chestnut brown, big strong haunches. Well, now, William, that's Mr. Skinner's son, he didn't really know how to ride, and Stanley needed to run. So he and I'd go out from time to time, and I'd just let him loose. Well, one time, when young Mr. Skinner was in New York City, you see, I rode Stanley all the way to my brother's place in East Hampton. Well, I know, that was a longer ride than usual, but Stanley loved it. Oh, folks, it was a beautiful night, you know, lots of stars, crisp night air. Beautiful fall night, you know, smoke coming up out of the chimneys, sound of your horse's hooves whooshing through the dry leaves. Well, we was halfway home, and Stanley fell. Oh, folks, it was bad. You wouldn't have believed it. He just fell clean out from underneath me. Neither one of us saw this hole in the ground until it was too late, and he just collapsed. I had to put him down. I mean, there was nothing else to be done. I tell you, though, that was one long walk home. Boy, and then when Mr. Skinner got back from New York City, boy, was he mad.
Excuse me.
Oh, Nellie, hi.
Excuse me, Mr. Brakey. Okay? I just thought you would need some clean water.
Oh, Nellie, very thoughtful. Yes, that would be great. Right now. Wonderful. Here you go. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Very thoughtful, Nellie. Yeah, what did Mrs. Kilborn say? Indispensable. There she is. Indispensable. Yep. Okay. Well, like I said, he was mad, but you know what I think? I think he was more upset that I had the nerve to take his horse out on my own personal business than he was at losing Stanley. Yeah. Well, guess you could say that me and young Mr. Skinner have had our share of problems. You know, I've even found stories about me in his journals. Well, I mean, not that I was looking to read his personal things, no, but, I mean, when the guy leaves his diary in the back of one of my cars, what am I supposed to do, huh? What was it? What was it that he called me? Oh, yeah, I remember. Shiftless. Yeah, and lazy. Well, you don't forget a thing like that. But what really got me was when he said, tried to take the Peerless for a ride, but the new chauffeur had fixed the car so it would not run. I don't know what he's talking about. She always ran for me. Yes, well, you know, we don't always see eye to eye, but when it comes down to it, he's never fired me. He knows I'm good for this place. Truth is, I'm always willing to be on call at their disposal. Well, sure, I mean, there's a phone right around the corner there with a direct line to my house. Bessie, my wife and me, we live right across the street there on Pine Street, right over there. It's a nice house. There's room for the family. Look, I don't mind the Skinners calling me when they need me. That's my job.
The Skinner family's chauffeur, George Brakey, as played by James Emery. The Skinner Servants Tour is playing at the Wisteria Hearst Museum in Holyoke, Massachusetts, from now through Sunday, March 15th. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to more information about the show. Well, we have some time left for poetry. Perugia Press is a wonderful little poetry press in Western Massachusetts that publishes works by women. The press has just given out their annual award for a first or second book of poetry. This year's winner is Nancy K. Pearson for her book, 2 Minutes of Light.
Don't wait up. It's dark on our street, growing darker, and the rain could ruin my beautiful shoes. Perhaps I'll get one more day. If so, I'll eat white foods, spaghetti with salt, an egg, hearts of palm to remember how many times last night we tumbled without waking, having given ourselves to the lumbering beast who pauses and asks nicely before swallowing us whole. I'm nearly home, but not ready to go in, not ready to be dry and warm under lamplight, with the book open to where the rooster gives perfectly good directions in English to the prince who will later reward him. I want to just sit here on somebody's porch steps. Let me soak to the bone, give my bones to the dark, give even my 3 fathers and my 16 mothers to the dark, and also to the dark each of the fat dreams they tucked into sealed envelopes for me. Best companion, don't wait up. Do you know my hieroglyph for you? The cross-section of a dog showing his doggy heart in his throat. And just now a bedraggled black Labrador crosses the lawn in slow zigzags. He sniffs. He doesn't look up. Occasional cars passed, black beetles who seem to lay and then carefully take up their own tracks. And here is the rain in the act of falling. I give you that. Charm to be read in the year 3494. Overheard. In only 1500 years, the language as we speak it now will not be recognizable as their own by our descendants, should they still be alive and speaking. Charm to be read in the year 3494. Beloved companions, grown warriors, old babies, students of the mosses and lichens, honored guests under our roof of starry nights, I am making you this charm. It shall not work to be read aloud. It shall not make you kitten among kittens, but tell you through pounce and tumble. It shall not keep your cottage hearts, hearts you've kept in order and disorder, through the weather of 15 centuries, but will let you back through straw, through wood, to the bricks of a tale that any good wolf can still blow down, if you are like us, if you are like us. Your nights are sometimes very long, yes? Your lover sleeps too far away, Spring comes to the planet. A baby won't stop crying, but then sucks and takes in milk, which is a bluish magic. If you are like us, the willows seem to weep, and they are gold before they're green, and a dear friend is too ill to travel. You save outgrown shoes and canceled stamps from a foreign country, detached from envelope and contents. You don't know why. This is my song and my charm, to live by your unborn fingertips and toes, to whisper rootlets, stems, leaves, and flowers of the vegetable kingdom, to whisper harvest, decay. If you are like us, you'll waste your time and find a thousand ways to stay awake, perfecting a lost music with the barred owls and loons.
Carol Edelstein. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to the Perugia Press. You can also find another poem by Carol Edelstein, and we'll be putting up our 2005 interview with Edelstein up on the site. Check back tomorrow. And finally, here's one of my favorite pieces of performance poetry, Galumph Dies Nuts by Anas Magani. It's from the book and CD set The Spoken Word Revolution Redux, the second in a series about slam, hip-hop, and performance poetry. Galumph Dies Nuts has the perfect tone to bring in spring, which, although still several weeks away, is definitely stirring in the wind.
This is called Galumph Dies Nuts. Galumph Dies shoulders, spines, eyes, and collarbones of mine. In my underwear, I write poetry. Two-headed poetry, three-legged poetry, poetry with tin spigots and no training wheels. There are gold flames airbrushed on my ass, and I have bare feet. Bare feet. I walk with big sticks in my ears. Speak up. I am filling twigs with sentences and filing my nails with memories. My love shaves diamonds. Scientists speculate over it. I come from the moon, kneel and buzz, and the third guy walked on my tummy. I giggled, and a spoonful of cherub tasted like cherries and wallabies. I write two-headed poetry. I write two underwear poems. I take off both underwear. Underwears. My poems dance around the candelabra naked in the living room. I write wrists and rubber bands on the backs of bathtubs. Press my lips to the shower's belly button and breathe. The goat man is in the woods dancing. The golden nugget. The chupacabra. The book man. There is a cloud splintering like a kneecap. Buy me pants. Buy me pants, mother. Buy me a hat. There are moths in my shoulders. I am shaking. I am full of love. I was full of love. I carved out pear-shaped slices of it and fed a million tired ankles. God sat on my shoulders. Like a cricket, I swatted a bee like a father's advice and asked for it again. Tell me where I can go when every bridge has wheels on it. I write poems with no training. I write my skull like it was a color I was picking up and examining. At Central Park East and 63rd Street, I clutch a football like a child and scream at a yellow wall. Go deep! Fling the big skin at the bricks, and as my childhood bounces back at me, try to snatch it in the end zone. I am the three-headed galumph, the blue giraffe, a water fountain on the moon. Catch me, carbon. Catch me, galumph. Catch me, galumph. Catcher, catch. Catch me, Lord, I am a hill. Find my dotted lines. Hold me like a bowl, like how the clouds hold the moon, like how its arms hold the rooftops of this city that holds me and mine memories. In my veins is a lonely mermaid singing. She is singing beautifully, so beautiful she sings, sings, singy, sings. Her throat is a girl I once knew. Her nose is made of silver. Her backbone a plum. Her backbone is a plum.
Galumph Dies Nuts by Anas Magani. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.